And within a quarter of an hour, Dorian said a prayer to Silva and swallowed it, cringing at the obscene sweetness. Nothing. Sorsha's eyes darted from his own to the pocket watch in her hand. Counting, waiting to see if there was an adverse reaction. A minute passed, and then 10. Dorian had to go soon, and so did she. But after a while, Sorsha quietly said,
"Try it. Try summoning it. The iron should be in your blood now."
He shut his eyes, and she added,
"It reacts when you're upset, angry or scared or sad. Think about something that makes you feel that way."
She was risking her position, her life, everything for this. For him, the son of the man who had ordered his army to destroy her village, then slaughter her family with the other unwanted immigrants squatting in Rifthold. He didn't deserve it. He breathed in. Out. She also didn't deserve the world of trouble he was bringing down upon her, or would continue to bring to her door every time he came here. He knew when women liked him, and he'd known from the first moment he'd seen her that she found him attractive. He'd hoped that opinion hadn't changed for the worse, but now...
"Think of what upsets you."
Everything upset him. It upset him that she was risking her life, that he had no choice but to endanger her. Even if he took that final step toward her, even if he took her into his bed like he so badly wanted to, he was still... the Crown Prince.
"You will always be my enemy," Selena had once said.
There was no escaping his crown, or his father, who would behead Sorsha, burn her, and scatter her ashes to the wind if he found out she'd helped him. His father, whom his friends were now working to destroy. They had lied to him and ignored him for that cause, because he was a danger. To them, to Sorsha, and... Roaring pain surged from his core and up his throat, and he gagged. There was another wave, and a cool breeze tried to kiss his face, but it vanished like mist under the sun as the pain trembled through him. He leaned forward, squeezing his eyes shut as the agony and then the nausea went through him again, and again. But then it was quiet. Dorian opened his eyes to find Sorsha. Clever, steady, wonderful Sorsha, standing there, biting her lip. She took one step, toward him, not away for once.
"Did it?"
Dorian was on his feet so fast the chair rocked behind him, and had her face between his hands a heartbeat after that.
"Yes," he breathed, and kissed her.
It was fast, but her face was flushed, and her eyes wide as he pulled back. His own eyes were wide, gods be damned, and he was still rubbing his thumb against her soft cheek, still contemplating going back for more, because that hadn't been nearly enough. But she pulled away, returning to her work. As if it hadn't been anything other than an embarrassment.
"Tomorrow?"
she murmured. She wouldn't look at him. He could hardly muster the words to tell her yes as he staggered out. She'd looked so surprised, and if he didn't get out, he was likely to kiss her again. But maybe she didn't want to be kissed. Chapter 27. Standing atop a viewing platform on the side of the Omega, Manon watched the first Yellowlegs coven of the day take the crossing. The plunge down, followed by the violent sweep up, was stunning, even when it was the Yellowlegs riders astride the wind. Leading them along the sheer face of the northern fang was Iskra. Her bull, a massive beast named Fendir, was a force of nature in himself. Though smaller than Titus, he was twice as nasty.
"They suit each other,"
Asterin said from beside Manon. The rest of the 13 were in the sparring room,
instructing the other covens in hand-to-hand combat. Phalene and Fallon, the green-eyed demon twins, were undoubtedly taking some pleasure from torturing the newest sentinels. They thrived on that sort of thing. Iskra and Fendir swept over the uppermost peak of the Northern Fang and vanished into the clouds, the other 12 riders trailing in tight formation. The cold wind whipped at Manon's face, beckoning to her. She was on her way to the caverns to see Abraxos, but she'd wanted to monitor the Yellowlegs crossing first, just to make sure they were truly gone for the next 3 hours. She looked across the span of the bridge to the Fang and its giant entryway. Screeching and roaring echoed from it, reverberating across the mountains. "I want you to keep the 13 occupied for the rest of the day," Manon said. As second, Asterin was the only one of the 13 with any sort of right to question her, and even then, it was only in very limited circumstances.
"You're going to train with him?"
Manon nodded.
"Your grandmother said she'd gut me if I let you out of my sight again."
Golden hair twining about her in the wind, Asterin's face, with its now crooked nose, was wary. "You're going to have to decide," Manon said, not bothering to bare her iron teeth. "Are you her spy or my second?" No hint of pain or fear or betrayal, just a slight narrowing of her eyes.
"I serve you."
"She's your matron."
"I serve you."
For a heartbeat, Manon wondered when she'd ever earned that kind of loyalty. They weren't friends, at least not in the way that humans seemed to be friends. Every Blackbeak already owed her their loyalty and obedience as the heir. But this... Manon had never explained herself, her plans, or her intentions to anyone except her grandmother. But she found herself saying to her second, "I'm still going to be wing leader." Asterin smiled, her iron teeth like quicksilver in the morning sun.
"We know."
Manon lifted her chin. "I want the 13 adding tumbling to their hand-to-hand training. And when you can handle your wyvern on your own, I want you in the skies when the Yellowlegs are aloft. I want to know where they fly, how they fly, and what they do." Asterin nodded.
"I already have the shadows watching the Yellowlegs in the halls," she said,
a glimmer of rage and bloodthirst in those gold-flecked black eyes. When Manon raised a brow, Asterin said,
"You didn't think I'd let Iskra off so easily, did you?"
Manon could still feel the iron-tipped fingers digging into her back, shoving her into the pit. Her ankle was sore and stiff from the fall, her ribs bruised from the beating she'd taken from Titus's tail. "Keep them in line, unless you want your nose broken a second time." Asterin flashed a grin.
"We don't move without your command, lady."
Manon didn't want the overseer in the pen, or his three handlers all bearing spears and whips. She didn't want any of them for 3 reasons. The first was that she wanted to be alone with Abraxos, who was crouched against the back wall, waiting and watching. The second was that the human smell of them, the beckoning warmth of the blood pulsing in their necks, was distracting. The stench of their fear was distracting. She debated for a good minute whether it would be worth it to gut one of them just to see what the others would do. Already men were going missing from the Fang. Men who were rumored to have crossed the bridge to the Omega and never returned. Manon hadn't killed any of the men here yet, but every minute alone with them tempted her to play. And the third reason she resented their presence was that Abraxos loathed them, with their whips and spears and chains and their hulking presence. The wyvern wouldn't move from his spot against the wall, no matter how viciously they cracked their whips. He hated whips. not just feared, but actually hated. The sound alone made him cringe and bare his teeth. They'd been in the pen for 10 minutes, attempting to get close enough to get him chained down and saddled. If it didn't happen soon, she'd have to go back to the Omega before the Yellow Legs returned.
"He's never taken a saddle,"
the overseer said to her.
"Probably won't."
She heard the unspoken words.
"I'm not going to risk my men getting it on him. You're just being proud. Pick another mount like a good girl."
Manon flashed her iron teeth at the overseer, her upper lip pulling back just enough to warn him. He backed up a step, whip drooping. Abraxos's mutilated tail slashed across the ground, his eyes never leaving the three men trying to force him into submission. One of them cracked the whip, so close to Abraxos that he flinched away. Another snapped it near his tail, twice. Then Abraxos lunged, with both neck and tail. The three handlers scrambled, barely out of reach of his snapping teeth.
"Enough."
"Your men have cowards' hearts," she said, giving the overseer a withering look as she stalked across the dirt floor. The overseer grabbed for her, but she slashed with iron-tipped fingers and sliced his hand open. He cursed, but Manon kept walking, licking his blood off her nails. She almost spat it out. "Vile." The blood tasted rotten, as if it had curdled or festered inside a corpse for days. She glanced at the blood on the rest of her hand. It was too dark for human blood. If witches had indeed been killing these men, why had no one reported this? She bit down the questions. She would think about it another time. Maybe drag the overseer into a forgotten corner and open him up to see what was decaying inside him. But right now, the men had gone quiet. Each step brought her closer to Abraxos. A line had been marked in the dirt where the safety of the chains ended. Manon took 3 steps beyond it, one for each face of their goddess. Maiden, mother, crone. Abraxos crouched, the powerful muscles of his body tense, ready to spring.
"You know who I am,"
Manon said, gazing into those endless black eyes, not giving 1 inch to fear or doubt.
"I am Manon Blackbeak, heir to the Blackbeak clan, and you are mine. Do you understand?"
One of the men snorted, and Manon might have whirled to tear out his tongue right there. But Abraxos... Abraxos lowered his head ever so slightly, as if he understood.
"You are Abraxos,"
Manon said to him, a chill slithering down her neck.
"I gave you that name because he is the great beast, the serpent who wrapped the world in his coils, and who will devour it at the very end when the three-faced goddess bids him to." "You are Abraxos," she repeated, "and you are mine."
A blink, then another. Abraxos took a step toward her. Leather groaned as someone tightened their grip on a coiled whip. But Manon held fast, lifting 1 hand toward her wyvern.
"Abraxos."
The mighty head came toward her, those eyes pools of liquid night meeting her own. Her hand was still extended, tipped in iron and stained with blood. He pressed his snout into her palm and huffed. His gray hide was warm and surprisingly soft, thick but supple, like worn leather. Up close, the variation in color was striking. Not just gray, but dark green, brown, black. It was marred all over by thick scars, so many that they could have been the stripes of a jungle cat. Abraxos's teeth, yellow and cracked, gleamed in the torchlight. Some were missing,
but those that remained were as long as a finger and twice as thick. His hot breath reeked, either from his diet or rotting teeth. Each of the scars, the chipped teeth and broken claws, the mutilated tail. They weren't the markings of a victim. Oh, no. They were the trophies of a survivor. Abraxos was a warrior who'd had all the odds stacked against him and survived. Learned from it. Triumphed. Manon didn't bother to look at the men behind her as she said, "Get out." She kept staring into those dark eyes. "Leave the saddle and get out. If you bring a whip in here again, I'll use it on you myself." "But now." Muttering and clicking their tongues, the handlers shuffled out and shut the gate. When they were alone, Manon stroked the massive snout. However the king had bred these beasts, Abraxos had somehow been born different. Smaller, but smarter. Or perhaps the others didn't ever need to think. Cared for and trained, they did what they were told. But Abraxos had learned to survive. And perhaps that had opened his mind. He could understand her words, her expressions. And if he could comprehend those things, he could possibly teach the other mounts of the 13. It was a small edge, but an edge that could make them wingleader and make them invincible against the king's enemies. "I am going to put this saddle on you," she said, still cupping that snout. He shifted, but Manon grabbed on tight, forcing him to look at her. "You want out of this shithole? Then you'll let me put this saddle on you to check the fit. And when we're done, you're going to let me look at your tail. Those human bastards cut off your spikes, so I'm going to build some for you. Iron ones, like mine," she said, and flashed her iron nails for him to see. "And fangs, too," she added, baring her iron teeth. "It's going to hurt, and you're going to want to kill the men who put them in. But you're going to let them do it. Because if you don't, then you will rot down here for the rest of your life. Understand?" A long, hot huff of air into her hands. "Once all that is done," she said, smiling faintly at her wyvern, "you and I are going to learn how to fly. And then we'll stain this kingdom red." Abraxos did everything she asked, though he growled at the handlers who inspected and poked and prodded, and nearly bit off the arm of the physician who had to dig out his rotted teeth to make way for the iron fangs. It took 5 days to do it all. He almost took out a wall when they welded the iron spikes onto his tail, but Manon stood with him the entire time, talking to him about what it was like to ride with the 13 on their ironwood brooms and hunt down the Kraken witches. She told the stories as much to distract him as she did to remind the men that if they made a mistake, if they hurt him, her retribution would be a long, bloody process. Not one of them made an error. During the 5 days they worked on him, she missed her riding lessons with the 13. And with each passing day, the window for getting Abraxos airborne became smaller and smaller. Manon stood with Asterin and Sorrel in the training hall, watching the tail end of the day's sparring session. Sorrel had been working with the youngest coven of Blackbeaks, all of them under 70 and few of them experienced. "How bad?" Manon asked, crossing her arms. Sorrel, small and dark-haired, crossed her arms as well. "Not as bad as we feared, but they're still sorting out coven dynamics, and their leader is..." Sorrel frowned at a mousy-looking witch who had just been thrown to the ground by an inferior. "I'd suggest either having her coven decide what to do with her, or picking a new leader. One weak coven in the wing and we could lose the war games." The coven leader was panting on the hard stone floor, nose dripping blue blood. Manon ground her teeth. "Give her 2 days. Let's see if she sorts herself out.
No need to have word of unstable covens get around. But have Vesta take her out tonight, Manon added, glancing to the red-haired beauty leading another coven in archery drills. To wherever she's been going to torment the men in the Northern Fang. Sorrel raised her thick brows innocently, and Manon rolled her eyes. You're a worse liar than Vesta. You think I haven't noticed those men grinning at her all hours of the day? Or the bite marks on them? Just keep the death toll down. We have enough to worry about as it is. We don't need a mutiny from the mortals. Asterin snorted, but when Manon gave her a sidelong look, the witch kept her gaze ahead, face all too innocent. Of course, if Vesta had been bedding and bleeding the men, then Asterin had been right there with her. Neither of them had reported anything about the men tasting strange. As you will it, lady, Sorrel said, a faint hint of color on her tan cheeks. If Manon was ice and Asterin was fire, then Sorrel was rock. Her grandmother had told her on occasion to make Sorrel her second, as ice and stone were sometimes too similar. But without Asterin's flame, without her second being able to rile up a host or rip out the throat of any challenger to Manon's dominance, Manon would not have led the 13 so successfully. Sorrel was grounded enough to even them both out. The perfect third. The only ones having fun right now, Asterin said, are the green-eyed demon twins. Indeed, the midnight-haired Phalene and Fallon were grinning with maniacal glee as they led three covens in knife-throwing exercises, using their inferiors as target practice. Manon just shook her head. Whatever worked, whatever shook the dust off these blackbeak warriors. And my shadows? Manon asked Asterin. How are they doing? Etta and Briar, two cousins that were as close as sisters, had been trained since infancy to blend into any sliver of darkness and listen. And they were nowhere to be seen in this hall, just as Manon had ordered. They'll have a report for you tonight, Asterin said. Distant cousins to Manon, the shadows bore the same moon-white hair. Or they had, until they'd discovered 80 years ago that the silver hair was as good as a beacon and dyed it solid black. They rarely spoke, never laughed, and sometimes even Asterin herself couldn't detect them until they were at her throat. It was their sole source of amusement, sneaking up on people, though they'd never dared do it to Manon. It was no surprise they'd taken two onyx wyverns. Manon eyed her second and third. I want you both in my room for their report, too. I'll have Lynn and Vesta stand watch, Asterin said. They were Manon's fallback sentries, Vesta for the disarming smiles, and Lynn because if anyone ever called her by her full name, Linnea, the name her soft-hearted mother had given her before Lynn's grandmother tore out her heart, that person wound up with missing teeth at best, a missing face at worst. Manon was about to turn away when she caught her second and third watching her. She knew the question they didn't dare ask, and said, I'll be airborne with Abraxos in a week, and then we'll be flying as one. It was a lie, but they believed her anyway. Chapter 28 Days passed, and not all of them were awful. Out of nowhere, Rowan decided to take Selena to the commune of healers 15 miles away, where the finest healers in the world learned, taught, and worked. Situated on the border between the Fey and mortal world, they were accessible to anyone who could reach them. It was one of the few good things Maeve had done. As a child, Selena had begged her mother to bring her. But the answer had always been no, accompanied by a vague promise that they would someday take a trip to the Torre Chesme in the southern continent, where many of the teachers had been taught by the Fae. Her mother had done everything she could to keep her from Maeve's clutches.
The irony of it wasn't wasted on her. So Rowan took her. She could have spent all day, all month, wandering the grounds under the clever, kind eyes of the head healer. But her time there was halved thanks to the distance and her inability to shift, and Rowan wanted to be home before nightfall. Honestly, while she'd actually enjoyed herself at the peaceful Riverside compound, she wondered whether Rowan had just brought her there to make her feel bad about the life she'd fallen into. It had made her quiet on the long hike back. And he didn't give her a moment's rest. They were to set out the following day on an overnight trip, but he wouldn't say where. Fantastic. Already making the day's bread, Emrys only looked faintly amused as Selena hurried in, stuffed her face with food and guzzled down tea, and hurried back out. Rowan was waiting by her rooms, a small pack dangling from his hands. He held it open for her. "Clothes," he said, and she stuffed the extra shirt and underclothes she'd laid out into the bag. He shouldered it, which she supposed meant he was in a good mood, as she'd fully expected to play pack mule on their way to wherever they were going. He didn't say anything until they were in the mist-shrouded trees, again heading west. When the fortress walls had vanished behind them, the wardstone zinging against her skin as they passed through. He stopped at last, throwing back the heavy hood of his jacket. She did the same, the cool air biting her warm cheeks. "Shift, and let's go," he said, his second words to her this morning. "And here I was thinking we'd become friends." He raised his brows and gestured with a hand for her to shift. "It's 20 miles, he said by way of encouragement, and gave her a wicked grin. "We're running. Each way." Her knees trembled at the thought of it. Of course he'd make this into some sort of torture session. Of course. "And where are we going?" He clenched his jaw, the tattoo stretching. "There was another body, a demi-fey from a neighboring fortress, dumped in the same area, same patterns. I want to go to the nearby town to question the citizens, but..." His mouth twisted to the side, then he shook his head at some silent conversation with himself. "But I need your help. It'll be easier for the mortals to talk to you."
"Is that a compliment?"
He rolled his eyes.
Perhaps yesterday's outing to the healer's compound hadn't been out of spite. Maybe he'd been trying to do something nice for her.
"Shift, or it'll take us twice as long."
"I can't. You know it doesn't work like that."
"Don't you want to see how fast you can run?"
"I can't use my other form in Otterlin anyway, so what's the point?"
Which was the start of a whole massive issue she hadn't yet let herself contemplate. "The point is that you're here now, and you haven't properly tested your limits." It was true. She hadn't really seen what she was capable of. "The point is, another husk of a body was found, and I consider that to be unacceptable."
Another body. From that creature.
A horrible, wretched death.
It was unacceptable.
He gave her braid a sharp, painful tug. "Unless you're still frightened." Her nostrils flared.
"The only thing that frightens me is how very much I want to throttle you." More than that, she wanted to find the creature and destroy it, for those it had murdered and for what it had made her walk through. She would kill it. Slowly.
A miserable sort of pressure and heat began building under her skin.
Rowan murmured,
"Hone it. The anger."
Was that why he'd told her about the body? Bastard.
Bastard for manipulating her, for making her pull double duty in the kitchen.
But his face was unreadable as he said,
"Let it be a blade, Aelin. If you cannot find the peace, then at least hone the anger that guides you to the shift.
Embrace and control it. It is not your enemy.
Aerobin had done everything he could to make her hate her heritage, to fear it. What he'd done to her, what she'd allowed herself to become.
This will not end well, she breathed.
He didn't back down.
See what you want, Aelin, and seize it. Don't ask for it. Don't wish for it. Take it.
I'm certain the average magic instructor would not recommend this to most people.
You are not most people, and I think you like it that way. If it's a darker set of emotions that will help you shift on command, then that's what we'll use. There might come a day when you find that anger doesn't work, or when it is a crutch. But for now...
A contemplative look.
It was the common denominator those times you shifted. Anger of varying kinds. So own it.
He was right. And she didn't want to think on it any more than that, or let herself get that enraged, not when she had been so angry for so long. For now. Selena took a long breath, then another. She let the anger anchor her, a knife slicing past the usual hesitation and doubt and emptiness. She brushed up against that familiar inner wall. No, a veil shimmering with soft light. All this time she thought she'd been reaching down for the power, but this was more of a reach in. Not a wish, but a command. She would shift, because there was a creature prowling these lands, and it deserved to pay. With a silent growl, she punched herself through the veil, pain shooting along every inch and pore as she shifted. A fierce, challenging grin, and Rowan moved, so fast she could hardly follow as he appeared on her other side and yanked on her braid again. When she whirled, he was already gone, and... She yelped as he pinched her side. Stop! He was standing in front of her now, a wild invitation in his eyes. She'd been studying the way he moved, his tricks and tells, the way he assumed she'd react. So when she crossed her arms, feigning the tantrum he expected, she waited. Waited, and then... He shot left to pinch or poke or hit her, and she whirled, slamming down his arm with an elbow and whacking him upside the head with her other hand. He stopped dead and blinked a few times. She smirked at him. He bared his teeth in a feral, petrifying grin.
Oh, you'd better run now.
When he lunged, she shot through the trees. She had a suspicion that Rowan was letting her get ahead for the first few minutes, because though she moved faster, she could barely adjust enough to her altered body to leap over rocks and fallen trees. He'd said they were going southwest, and that was where she went, dodging between the trees, the anger simmering away, shifting into something else entirely. Rowan was a silver and white streak beside her and behind her, and every time he got too close, she veered the other way, testing out the senses that told her where the trees were without seeing them. The smell of oak and moss and living things. The open coolness of the mist passing between them like a path that she followed. They hit a plateau, the ground easy beneath her boots. Faster. She wanted to see if she could go faster, if she could outrun the wind itself. Rowan appeared at her left, and she pumped her arms, her legs, savoring the breath in her lungs, smooth and calm, ready to see what she would do next. More. This body wanted more. She wanted more. And then she was going swifter than she ever had in her life, the trees a blur, her immortal body singing as she let its rhythms fall into place. Her powerful lungs gobbled down the misty air and filled with the smell and taste of the world. Only instinct and reflex guiding her, telling her she could go faster still, feet eating up the loamy earth step by step by step. Gods. Oh, gods. She could have flown, could have soared for the sudden surge of ecstasy in her blood, the sheer freedom granted by the marvel of creation that was her body. Rowan shot at her from the right, but she dodged a tree with such ease she let out a whoop, then threw herself between two long-hanging branches, mere hurdles that she landed with feline skill. Rowan was at her side again, lunging with a snap of his teeth, but she whirled and leapt over a rock, letting the moves she'd honed as an assassin blend into the instincts of her fey body. She could die for love of this speed, this surety in her bones. How had she been afraid of this body for so long? Even her soul felt looser, as if she had been locked up and buried, and was only now starting to shake free. Not joy, perhaps not ever, but a glimmer of what she had been before grief had decimated her so thoroughly. Rowan raced beside her, but made no move to grab her. No, Rowan was playing. He threw a glance at her, breathing hard but evenly, and it might have been the sun through the canopy, but she could have sworn that she saw his eyes alight with a glimmer of that same feral contentment. She could have sworn he was smiling. It was the fastest 20 miles of her life. Granted, the last 5 were slower, and by the time Rowan brought them to a halt, they were both gulping down air. It was only then, as they stared at each other between the trees, that she realized the magic hadn't once flared, hadn't once tried to overpower or erupt. She could feel it waiting down in her gut, warm but calm, slumbering. She wiped the sweat from her brow, her neck, her face. Though she was panting, she still could have run for miles more. Gods, if she had been this fast the night Nehemia had... It wouldn't have made a difference. Nehemia had orchestrated every step in her own destruction, and would have found another way. And she had only done it because Selena refused to help, refused to act. Having this glorious fey body changed nothing. She blinked, realizing she'd been staring at Rowan, and that whatever satisfaction she'd seen on his face had again turned to ice. He tossed something at her. The shirt he'd carried with him. Change. He turned and stripped off his own shirt. His back was just as tan and scarred as the rest of him. But seeing those markings didn't make her want to show him what her own ruined back looked like. So she moved between the trees until she was sure he couldn't see her, and swapped her shirt. When she returned to where he'd dumped the pack, he tossed her a skein of water, which she gulped down. It tasted. She could taste each layer of minerals in the water, and the musk of the skein itself. By the time they strode into the red-roofed little town, Selena could breathe again. They quickly learned that it was almost impossible to get anyone to talk, especially to 2 fey visitors. Selena debated returning to her human form, but with her accent and ever-worsening mood, she was fairly certain a woman from Otterlin wouldn't be much better received than a fey. Windows were shuttered as they passed, probably because of Rowan, who looked like nothing short of death incarnate. But he was surprisingly calm with the villagers they approached. He didn't raise his voice, didn't snarl, didn't threaten. He didn't smile, but for Rowan he was downright cheerful. Still, it got them nowhere. No, they had not heard of a missing demi-fey or any other bodies. No, they had not seen any strange people lurking about. No, livestock were not disappearing, though there was a chicken thief a few towns away. No, they were perfectly safe and protected in Wendlin, and didn't appreciate fey and demi-fey poking into their business either. Selena had given up on flirting with a pock-faced stable boy at the inn, who had just gawked at her ears and canines as though she were one heartbeat away from eating him alive. She stalked down the pleasant main street, hungry and tired,
and annoyed that they were indeed going to need their bedrolls, because the innkeeper had already informed them he had no vacancies. Rowan fell into step beside her, the storm clouds in his eyes saying enough about how his conversation with the taproom maid had gone. I could believe it was a half-wild creature if at least some of them knew these people had vanished, she mused. But consistently selecting someone who wouldn't be missed or noticed? It must be sentient enough to know who to target. The demi-fae has to be a message, but what? To stay away? Then why leave bodies in the first place? She tugged at the end of her braid, stopping in front of a clothier's window. Simple, well-cut dresses stood on display, not at all like the elegant, intricate fashions in Rifthold. She noticed the wide-eyed, pale shopkeeper a heartbeat before the woman slashed the curtains shut. Well, then. Rowan snorted, and Selena turned to him. You're used to this, I assume?
A lot of the Fae who venture into mortal lands have earned themselves a reputation for taking what they want. It went unchecked for too many years. But even though our laws are stricter now, the fear remains.
A criticism of Maeve? Who enforces these laws?
A dark smile. I do. When I'm not off campaigning, my aunt has me hunt down the rogues.
And kill them? The smile remained.
If the situation calls for it. Or I just haul them back to Doranel and let Maeve decide what to do with them.
I think I'd prefer death at your hands to death at Maeve's.
That might be the first wise thing you've said to me.
The demi-fae said you have 5 other warrior friends. Do they hunt with you? How often do you see them?
I see them whenever the situation calls for it. Maeve has them serve her as she sees fit, as she does with me.
Every word was clipped.
It is an honor to be a warrior serving in her inner circle.
Selena hadn't suggested otherwise, but she wondered why he felt the need to add it. The street around them was empty. Even food carts had been abandoned. She took a long breath, sniffing, and... Was that chocolate? Did you bring any money?
A hesitant lift of his brow. Yes. They won't take your bribes, though.
Good. More for me, then. She pointed out the pretty sign swaying in the sea breeze. Confectionery. If we can't win them with charm, we might as well win them with our business.
Did you somehow not hear what I just...
But she had already reached the shop, which smelled divine and was stocked with chocolates and candies and, oh gods, hazelnut truffles. Even though the confectioner blanched as the two of them overpowered the space, Selena gave the woman her best smile.
Over her rotting corpse was she letting these people get away with shutting curtains in her face, or letting them think that she was here to plunder.
Nehemia had never once let the preening, bigoted idiots in Rifthold shut her out of any store, dining room, or household. And she had the sense that her friend might have been proud of the way she went from shop to shop that afternoon, head held high, and charmed the ever-loving hell out of those villagers. Once word spread that the two fae strangers were spending silver on chocolates, then a few books, then some fresh bread and meat, the streets filled again. Vendors bearing everything from apples to spices to pocket watches were suddenly eager to chat, so long as they sold something. When Selena popped into the cramped messenger's guild to mail a letter, she managed to ask a few novices if they'd been hired by anyone of interest. They hadn't, but she still tipped them handsomely. Rowan dutifully carried every bag and box Selena bought, save the chocolates, which she ate as she strolled around, one after another after another. When she offered one to him, he claimed he didn't eat sweets. Ever. Not surprising. The villagers wound up not knowing anything, which she supposed was good, because it meant that they hadn't been lying.
But the crabmonger did say he'd found a few discarded knives. Small, sharp as death knives, in his nets recently. He tossed them all back into the water as gifts for the sea god. The creature had sucked these people dry, not cut them up. So it was likely that Wendwinite soldiers had somehow lost a trunk of their blades in some storm. At sunset, the innkeeper even approached them about a suddenly vacant suite. The very best suite in town, he claimed. But Selena was starting to wonder whether they might attract the wrong sort of attention, and she wasn't particularly in the mood to see Rowan disembowel a would-be thief. So she politely refused, and they set out down the street, the light turning thick and golden as they entered the forest once more. Not a bad day, she realized, as she nodded off under the forest canopy. Not bad at all. Her mother had called her Fireheart. But to her court, to her people, she would one day be queen. To them, she was the heir to two mighty bloodlines, and to a tremendous power that would keep them safe and raise their kingdom to even greater heights. A power that was a gift. Or a weapon. That had been the near-constant debate for the first 8 years of her life. As she grew older, and it became apparent that while she'd inherited most of her mother's looks, she'd received her father's volatile temper and wildness. The wary questions became more frequent, asked by rulers in kingdoms far from their own. And on days like this, she knew that everyone would hear of the event, for better or worse. She was supposed to be asleep, and was wearing her favorite silk nightgown, her parents having tucked her in minutes ago. Though they had told her they weren't, she knew they were exhausted and frustrated. She'd seen the way the court was acting, and how her uncle had put a gentle hand on her father's shoulder and told him to take her up to bed. But she couldn't sleep, not when her door was cracked open, and she could hear her parents from their bedroom in the suite they shared in the upper levels of the White Castle. They thought they were speaking quietly, but it was with an immortal's ears that she listened in the near dark.
"I don't know what you expect me to do, Evelyn," her father said.
She could almost hear him prowling before the giant bed on which she had been born.
"What's done is done."
"Tell them it was exaggerated. Tell them the librarians were making a fuss over nothing," her mother hissed. "Start a rumor that someone else did it, trying to pin the blame on her."
"This is all because of Maeve?"
"This is because she is going to be hunted, Ro, for her whole life. Maeve and others will hunt her for this power."
"And you think agreeing to let those little bastards ban her from the library will prevent that? Tell me, why does our daughter love reading so much?"
"That has nothing to do with it."
"Tell me."
When her mother didn't respond, her father growled.
"She is 8, and she has told me that her dearest friends are characters in books."
"She has Adian."
"She has Adian because he is the only child in this castle who isn't petrified of her, who hasn't been kept away because we have been lax with her training. She needs training, Ev. Training and friends. If she doesn't have either, that's when she'll turn into what they're afraid of."
Silence. And then, a huff from beside her bed.
"I'm not a child,"
Adian hissed from where he sat in a chair, arms crossed. He'd slipped in here after her parents had left, to talk quietly to her, as he often did when she was upset.
"And I don't see why it's a bad thing if I'm your only friend."
"Quiet," she hissed back.
Though Adian couldn't shift, his mixed blood allowed him to hear with uncanny range and accuracy, better even than hers. And though he was 5 years older, he was her only friend. She loved her court, yes, loved the adults who pampered and coddled her.
but the few children who lived in the castle kept away, despite their parents' urging. Like dogs, she'd sometimes thought. The others could smell her differences.
"She needs friends her age," her father went on. "Maybe we should send her to school. Cal and Marion have been talking about sending a lead next year."
"No schools, and certainly not that so-called magic school, when it's so close to the border, and we don't know what Otterlin is planning."
Adian loosed a breath, his legs propped on the mattress. His tan face was angled toward the cracked door, his golden hair shining faintly. But there was a crease between his brows. Neither of them took well to being separated, and the last time one of the castle boys had teased him for it, Adian had spent a month shoveling horse dung for beating the boy into a pulp. Her father sighed.
"Ev, don't kill me for this, but you're not making this easy. For us or for her."
Her mother was quiet, and she heard a rustle of clothing and a murmur of, "I know, I know," before her parents started speaking too quietly for even her fey ears. Adian growled again, his eyes, their matching eyes, gleaming in the dark.
"I don't see what all the fuss is about. So what if you burned a few books? Those librarians deserve it. When we're older, maybe we'll burn it to the ground together."
She knew he meant it. He'd burn the library, the city, or the whole world to ashes if she asked him. It was their bond, marked by blood and scent and something else she couldn't place. A tether as strong as the one that bound her to her parents. Stronger, in some ways. She didn't answer him, not because she didn't have a reply, but because the door groaned, and before Adian could hide, her bedroom flooded with light from the foyer. Her mother crossed her arms. Her father, however, let out a soft laugh, his brown hair illuminated by the hall light, his face in shadow.
"Typical,"
he said, stepping aside to clear a space for Adian to leave.
"Don't you have to be up at dawn to train with Quinn? You were 5 minutes late this morning. 2 days in a row will earn you a week on stable duty. Again."
In a flash, Adian was on his feet and gone. Alone with her parents, she wished she could pretend to sleep. But she said,
"I don't want to go away to school."
Her father walked to her bed, every inch the warrior Adian aspired to be. A warrior prince, she heard people call him, who would one day make a mighty king. She sometimes thought her father had no interest in being king, especially on days when he took her up into the Staghorns and let her wander through Oakwald in search of the Lord of the Forest. He never seemed happier than at those times, and always seemed a little sad to go back to Orinth.
"You're not going away to school," he said,
looking over his broad shoulder at her mother, who lingered by the doorway, her face still in shadow.
"But do you understand why the librarians acted the way they did today?"
Of course she did. She felt horrible for burning the books. It had been an accident, and she knew her father believed her. She nodded and said,
"I'm sorry."
"You have nothing to be sorry for," her father said, a growl in his voice.
"I wish I was like the others," she said.
Her mother remained silent, unmoving, but her father gripped her hand.
"I know, love, but even if you were not gifted, you would still be our daughter. You would still be a Galathinius and their queen one day."
"I don't want to be queen."
Her father sighed. This was a conversation they'd had before. He stroked her hair.
"I know," he said again. "Sleep now. We'll talk about it in the morning."
They wouldn't, though. She knew they wouldn't, because she knew there was no escaping her fate, even though sometimes she prayed to the gods that she could. She lay down again nonetheless, letting him kiss her head and murmur goodnight. Her mother still said nothing, but as her father walked out, Evelyn remained, watching her for a long while. Just as she was drifting off, her mother left, and as she turned, she could have sworn that tears gleamed on her pale face. Selena jolted awake, hardly able to move, to think. It had to be the smell of that god's damned body yesterday that had triggered the dream. It was agony seeing her parents' faces, seeing Adian. She blinked, focusing on her breathing, until she was no longer in that beautiful jewel box-like room, until the scent of the pine and snow on the northern wind had vanished, and she could see the morning mist weaving through the canopy of leaves above her. The cold, damp moss seeped through her clothes. The brine of the nearby sea hung thick in the air. She lifted her hand to examine the long scar carved on her palm.
"Do you want breakfast?"
Rowan asked, from where he crouched over unlit logs, the first fire she'd seen him assemble. She nodded, then rubbed her eyes with the heels of her palms.
"Then start the fire,"
he said.
"You can't be serious."
He didn't deign to respond. Groaning, she rotated on her sleeping roll until she sat cross-legged facing the logs. She held a hand toward the wood.
"Pointing is a crutch. Your mind can direct the flames just fine."
"Perhaps I like the dramatics." He gave her a look she interpreted to mean, "Light the fire, now." She rubbed her eyes again and concentrated on the logs.
"Easy,"
Rowan said. And she wondered if that was approval in his voice, as the wood began to smoke.
"A knife, remember? You are in control."
A knife, carving out a small bit of magic. She could master this. Light one single fire. Gods, she was so heavy again. That stupid dream, memory, whatever it was, today would be an effort. A pit yawned open inside her, the magic rupturing out before she could shout a warning. She incinerated the entire surrounding area. When the smoke and flames cleared, thanks to Rowan's wind, he merely sighed.
"At least you didn't panic and shift back into your human form."
She supposed that was a compliment. The magic had felt like a release, a thrown punch. The pressure under her skin had lessened. So Selena just nodded. But shifting, it seemed, was to be the least of her problems. Chapter 29. It had just been a kiss, Sorsha told herself every day afterward. A quick, breathless kiss that had made the world spin. The iron in the treacle had worked, though it bothered Dorian enough that they started to toy with the dosage, and ways to mask it. If he were caught ingesting powders at all hours of the day, it would lead to questions. So it became a daily contraceptive tonic, because no one would bat an eye at that, not with his reputation. Sorsha was still reassuring herself that the kiss had meant nothing more than a thank you, as she reached the door to Dorian's tower room, his daily dose in hand. She knocked, and the prince called her inside. The assassin's hound was sprawled on his bed, and the prince himself was lounging on his shabby couch. He sat up, however, and smiled at her in that way of his.
"I think I found a better combination. The mint might go down better than the sage," she said, holding up the glass of reddish liquid.
He came toward her, but there was something in his gait, a kind of prowl, that made her straighten.
especially as he set down the glass and stared at her, long and deep.
What?
She breathed, backing up a step.